I'm Steve Bigeau, and this is Steve Bigeau's Down Home Corner. If you're from Canada's East Coast and proud of your roots, you're a Down Homer, and we are all connected. On today's show, we connect with former radio voice of the Calgary Flames and member of the Hockey Hall of Fame, Down Homer Peter Marr. Welcome to the show. This is Webisode 2, and we are thrilled at your response in our first show. Exciting, by the way. Response was so good that we had over 1,000 listens, more than 500 downloads, and exceeded our monthly bandwidth in just 48 hours. Kind of cool. So we had to buy more bandwidth to make sure that problem was going to be rectified. Everything is hunky-dory now, and we hope you will continue to listen and to download. By the way, here's some stats for you. We have listeners all over Canada, the U.S., Britain, Sweden, Europe, and as an added bonus, we had 3 listens in the country of Ghana, including a download. So somebody really liked the show in Ghana. Now, who is living in Ghana from down home, from the East Coast? I have no idea, but I'm glad they're listening. And I hope they pass it around to the other large community of down homers in Ghana as well. Now, anyway, we now have a Facebook page that's Down Home Corner, one word, Down Home, Down Home Corner. And you can check us out, and please like us because we like you, okay? By the way, we'll put up links to the show, and we'll put up a bunch of different things here, some cool things. Like, for instance, I was the only person, I'm letting you in on something here, I was the only person who got a clean recording of Peter Marr's acceptance speech when he was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2006. Now, we'll get it up there for you if you want to listen to it. We'll have it up on our Facebook page. And like I say, a whole bunch of other things. Now, so do check us out and give us a like if you would. It really helps us out, and it helps us to connect to other Down Homers out there. Facebook page, again, is Down Home Corner. Also, we have an email address, downhomecorner@hotmail.com. Downhomecorner, one word, at hotmail.com. So send us any comments you might have about the show or ideas, or even ideas for Down Homers that you think might make a good guest on our show. We would love to hear from you. Again, downhomecorner@hotmail.com. And thank you, by the way. The show is indebted, as am I, to Leslie Ann Ferguson. Leslie designed the show's logo, Facebook page. She set up our email, is probably hard at work on the show's new website as you listen. And that doesn't matter what time of the day you're listening, by the way. You don't know Leslie. So thank you so much, Leslie, especially for your support, your belief, and encouragement in me and in this project. Now, I thought we had an email to read to you, but it was a mistake. Someone apparently sent us this email thinking they were emailing the program Extreme Home Makeovers. Now, I don't know how that happened, but, you know, mistakes happen in the cyber world. Like recently, I texted my producer, Mike, and said, "I love you with all my heart." And I thought I was texting Leslie. I didn't know. And he was very gracious. He sent one back to me and he said, "We haven't known each other that long, Steve." So that was kind of nice. But anyway, here's this email that Extreme Home Makeovers got, and I guess the right thing would have been to send it on to them and not read it, but I read it, and it's so touching. Seriously, I want you to hear this, okay? Check this out. Listen to this. This is really, really cool. It says, "Dear Extreme Home Makeovers, I have been in need of a home makeover for some time now, but sadly, I can't seem to find the funds I need. I am old, sluggish, and I just don't have the energy I once did. Some say I'm dangerous, destructive even, but at the end of the day, all I'm trying to do is my job. And many, by the way, would be left in the cold and in the dark if I suddenly didn't exist anymore. Please, please help. I need an extreme home makeover. All I'm asking for is money." And it's signed, Point Lepreau Nuclear Power Plant.
Growing up in Campbellton, New Brunswick in the 1970s, as a young man with an active mind, I realized to survive those long, cold North Shore winters, I had to do something with my time and energy. So as an intelligent young fellow, I figured I had 2 choices. For you younger listeners, this was a time when there was no internet, no cell phones, laptop computers, or even Xboxes. And you couldn't download your favorite music on your MP3 player or iPhone because there was no MP3 player or iPhone. You know how we listen to music? A radio, a tape player, or these big black vinyl discs they called records, which you got from record stores or from your older brother or sister's collection. But hey, that was back then. Like I say, I was presented with two choices. Become a dedicated student, study hard, always do my homework, and plan for my future. Or go out and play hockey. Now, it was a tough choice, let me tell you. And I thought about it each and every time, long and hard. And in the end, I always gave in. I went out and played hockey.
Hello out there, we're on the air. It's hockey night tonight. Tension grows, the whistle blows, and the puck goes down the ice. The goalie jumps and the players bump and the fans all go insane. Someone roars, Bobby scores at the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Second period, where players dash with skates aflash, the home team trails behind. But they grab the puck and go bursting up, and they're down across the line. They storm the crease like bumblebees, they travel like a burning flame. We see them slide the puck inside, it's a 1-1 hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Third period, last game in the playoffs too. Oh, take me where the hockey players face off down the rink. And the Stanley Cup is all filled up for the champs who win the drink. Now the final flick of a hockey stick and a one gigantic scream. The puck is in, the home team wins the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game. Oh, the good old hockey game is the best game you can name. And the best game you can name is the good old hockey game.
Peter Marr was born and raised in Campbellton, New Brunswick. He attended high school at Campbellton High, which is now Campbellton Middle School. During his teen years in the 60s, he was hired by CKNB Radio after station manager Doug Young heard Peter call ball games as public address announcer at Riverside Park Ballfield, which is where the Campbellton Memorial Civic Center now stands. Peter went on to broadcast Campbellton Tiger hockey games and eventually also became the general manager of the Tigers. When I was 12 years old, I listened to Peter broadcast the Tigers' first Hardy Cup win in Rosetown, Saskatchewan in 72, and the Tigers' win at home against War Road, Minnesota's team when the Tigers became the first and only team to repeat as Hardy Cup champions. Canadian champions. In 1978, Peter left Campbellton to become a radio voice of the Toronto Maple Leafs, and in 1980 joined the Calgary Flames, where he called every period of every game till retirement in April of 2014. He was inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame in 2006 in the media category, winning the Foster Hewitt Memorial Award, which is interesting because in 78, when Peter joined the Leafs as play-by-play man, he technically replaced Foster Hewitt, whose radio station lost the contract to upstart and short-lived CKO Radio Network. It was a controversial move at the time, when a Hall of Fame broadcaster was replaced by a guy who had been broadcasting to a town of 10,000 people. Peter's famous catchphrases? Well, he had three. Yeah, baby, which he would say only on special occasions, like the Flames' Stanley Cup win in 89, Marty Jelena's overtime goal that sent the Flames to the Stanley Cup final in 2004, or when Jerome Iginla scored his 500th goal as a Flame. Catchphrase number two. Put it in the win column. Peter said this after every Flame victory. And the third phrase for older CKNB listeners, rounding third and heading for home, which is the way he signed off his radio sports broadcasts back in the 70s. What I do beats working, Peter always said. Perhaps that's why he never missed an assignment, even with the Tigers and Dalhousie Rangers.
Now, Peter, this program, we say we're all connected, and everyone has a story. And, of course, you would have a million stories and everything. But your timeline intersects my timeline a little bit at times, for a short period. I remember I was 10 years old, and I went to a hockey game at Memorial Gardens. And it was an exhibition game between the Campbellton Tigers and the Nova Scotia Voyageurs. You pick up the story from there. It was a first for you.
Yeah, that was the very first. That night would be the very first hockey game that I ever did play-by-play that had an audience. I did some play-by-play prior to that in tape recorders or just doing a play-by-play while I was watching a game. But that was the first time I actually got on the air, and that was a game that saw that actually Memorial Gardens in Campbellton, which of course is no longer there, unfortunately burned down. I think it was 20, 25 years ago now. It's quite a while ago anyway. That's where I started, and they had renovated the building, and to reopen it after the renovations, they had an exhibition game there involving the Nova Scotia Voyageurs, who then were in Halifax, played in the American Hockey League, a Montreal Canadiens farm team, against the they came in and played a game against the local senior team, intermediate team there, the Campbellton Tigers, and that was the first game that I ever broadcast. And Larry Robinson played defense in that game for the Voyageurs, as he was just starting out his professional career that ultimately would see him become a Hall of Fame player, now as a coach in the NHL with San Jose as an assistant and has coached elsewhere prior. And I, at one point I went to him and I said to him, you know, the very first game I ever broadcast, Larry, you played in that game. And I told him about that night at Memorial Gardens, and he remembered the night. And so I got a hockey stick and asked him to autograph it for me. So he did that, and I still have that as a very treasured memory from that night. So that's where it all started.
Very cool. Also in that game was a local hockey legend and businessman Robert Allen.
Yes, Robert Allen played in that game. He was a big strapping defenseman with the Tigers, and he had just come back to Campbellton. He'd been away and had played some in the pro ranks, and had come back and it was hometown and all in business, and he played some hockey for the Tigers for a number of years there. He was a member of the first of three Campbellton Tiger teams that would win the Hardy Cup as Canadian Intermediate champions. That team, the first time, won in 1971-72, and also won again in 1977. And then in 1978, the Tigers again, with Robert as part of that team, went to Prince George, B.C. to play in the final for the Canadian championship, and unfortunately lost that playoff series. And that would be the last time that I would broadcast a Campbellton Tiger game, because it was the next year that I moved from Campbellton to Toronto to begin my NHL career as the Maple Leafs play-by-play guy.
Now, Peter, in that game as well was another well-known name at the time, Al McNeil, who was coach of the Nova Scotia Voyageurs, and he had the dubious distinction of being fired by the Montreal Canadiens after winning a Stanley Cup.
And that was the first time, Steve, that Al McNeil and I actually met. And of course, he's a Maritimer from Cape Breton. And we would, as a result, or after that, would lock up horns again in Calgary, and to this day are still friends and still see each other on a regular basis. So it was kind of ironic. He was the general manager coach of the Voyageurs in that game in 1970 after, as you mentioned, having coached the Canadiens to a Stanley Cup title and then losing his job and then going back and coaching again in the minors. And, yeah, he was behind the bench for the Voyageurs in that game at Memorial Gardens back in September or October, I guess it was, of 1970. And then later he would go on to coach Atlanta in the NHL. And then when the Flames moved from Atlanta to Calgary, he was the head coach for the first 2 years that the team had in Calgary. And after he stepped aside as coach of the team, he remained on as the assistant general manager for the Flames for a number of years, including their Stanley Cup championship year in 1989, and still involved. He's in retirement now, but is still involved with the Flames. I see him quite frequently at the Saddle Dome when he comes for games and comes for practices. We get together once in a while for lunch or breakfast or whatever. So it was the start of a long, long association with a fellow Maritimer who was a great, great friend. In fact, you know, the night that I was offered the auditioned for the job in Toronto with the Maple Leafs, it was what had happened there is that I was in Campbellton in September, the Labor Day long weekend. There was a ball tournament going on at Riverside Park in Campbellton, and I was involved in that. And Robbie Robinson, who was a former player and was also involved in coaching and managing with the Tigers, he came to me while that was going on and said, "There's something in the paper that you should see." And there was a story that was about a 3-paragraph story that was kind of buried in the sports section of, I believe it was the St. John or Telegraph Journal. And it showed that the radio broadcast rights of the Maple Leafs had moved from Foster Hewitt Station to another station in Toronto, a new up-and-coming station, CKLFM. And they said in the story that they were looking for a play-by-play guy. Didn't know if it would be somebody who had experience or they'd start somebody new. So there was a name of a guy, David Ruskin, in there. So I phoned David on the Tuesday after the long weekend, and he said, "Send tapes and resumes and so on," which I did. And then they listened to all that and asked me to go to Toronto for a preseason game at Maple Leaf Gardens that involved the Leafs and the Canadians. And Al was working for the Canadians that year. And that was just before he went to Atlanta. And before the game, I told him what I was doing there. And he said, I asked him, "Well, what do you think?" He said, "Well, if you can get the job, that'll be great. Great for you." And as it turned out, after I broadcast one period, and the two other guys also broadcast a period of that particular game, the people that were making a decision on who to hire listened to the recordings of it and called me about 2 hours after I got back home the next day and said the job was mine. And that was on a Thursday. They wanted me in Toronto the next day, the Friday, to do a dry run on the Saturday night. Then I go home on Sunday. Had a going away party on Monday. I left on Tuesday for Toronto to begin my career in the NHL. So it all happened really, really fast. And Al McNeil, as I mentioned, was involved in that as well.
Wow. So a week that really changed your life.
Yeah. I mean, I went from, I like to say, I went in a week, I went from a town of 7,000 people to a city of 7 million. And went from the North Shore Hockey League in New Brunswick to the National Hockey League. So it was at the time when I look back on it, it was quite a surreal adventure and intimidating as well, given the parameters there that we just talked about, going from such a small city and such a small league and that sort of thing to the Canada's biggest city and the NHL, the greatest league in the world. So it was quite a time. And fortunately, when I look back, it was good it happened that way. I didn't have a whole lot of time to think about what was going on and the pressures that were there. There were enough pressures anyway, but I didn't have enough time to put any added pressure on myself. So it all worked out for the best.
David Ruskin, I had the good fortune of being able to sit with at your luncheon ceremony during your Hall of Fame induction ceremony. And he was saying that he had liked your language, the way you used colorful language in your broadcast. So even back then, you were looking for catchphrases or different words that would somehow paint a different picture. He said the couple that stood out for him were you said stanza instead of period, and you referred to the net as the cage instead of the net.
Yeah, but that, right from a young time in my play-by-play broadcast career, I was looking for alternate words to use to describe some of the things that were involved in a hockey game, so it wouldn't sound so repetitious. And he picked up on that. And the other thing that I was told that really stood out for them was that when they listened to the tapes of myself and the other two guys, is that they had a table hockey game there, and they had a pointer that they would place on the ice, if you will. On the table hockey thing, which had the lines on and all that type of deal. And from the commentator's comments or the play-by-play guy's comments, they would move that pointer around just to see how the picture was being painted and how accurate and knowing where it was. And I was told that I was very, very strong in that category. And I've always remembered that. And right to the very end, it was something that was very cognizant of making sure that the fans that were listening knew where the puck was and who had it. And when you do it on radio, that is a very important element of broadcasting. On television, not so much, since the people that are watching can see it. And you know, that brings up an interesting story, too, is that from 1983 to 1986, I was broadcasting all of the Flame games then on the radio. They were trying to get me to go back to Toronto as a television broadcaster. I wouldn't accept the offers that they made to go back, but they said, well, we'd like to have you whenever we can for our midweek games, which were on basically on Wednesday nights, and Maple Leafs would play games that would be televised on CHCH channel in Hamilton at the time. And so whenever I could, I'd go and do those games, and it was a whole different style, and you really had to focus your mindset into what you were doing and what you were saying, and that make sure that you were aware that one was on radio, one was on television. So what I did in the television games is I'd take a piece of elastic and put it on one of my fingers with just enough stress on there that I could feel it all the way through, and that was my reminder that it was a game that was on television rather than radio. So it was kind of little tricks like that get you through.
That's very cool. Those are really cool connections, and how you connected into the game and was able to bring that picture to the fans. You kind of hedged your bet there for a season doing double duty, though. How tough on you was that? What age were you when you were doing that?
Well, a lot younger than I am today. I mean, I did that for three. I did that for three seasons, and when I look back on that, I wonder, how did I do that? Because what would happen most of the time was that the Flames, and the schedule worked out pretty good because the Flames played a lot of games on Tuesday nights. So I would do that game a lot in Calgary. And when the game would end, I'd go to the airport and hop on a red-eye flight to Toronto that would get me in there around 7 in the morning. And then I would go to the hotel, check in and get some rest, and then do some preparation, and then go to the game on Wednesday night, do the play-by-play on television. And after the game, I rushed to the airport in Toronto, and there was a flight that left there around 11 o'clock or 11:30, somewhere in that range anyway. So it would get me back in Calgary, you know, in the 2-3 in the morning, and with the time difference. And then I'd get ready for another game, a radio game on Tuesday night or Thursday night involving the Flames. And when I look back on it, I just shake my head. I don't know how I did it, but obviously a whole lot younger than I am today. I think in those days I was around 33 to 36, somewhere there. Yeah, I think those were the exact ages I was when I was doing those 3 years. And then at the end of it, after the third year that I was doing that, Don Wallace was at that time the executive producer for Hockey Night in Canada, and he came to me and he said, "Well, Peter, we gotta either get you down here full time, or we're gonna have to end this because we can't have you going back and forth and wanting to get somebody regular." So they made me another offer. At that time, they didn't have the Saturday night doubleheaders that the people were in control of that I was working for. They just had the one game. And I remember Don saying, "Well, we'll get you some Saturday night games, but mostly it'll be games midweek, Wednesday primarily, that you would broadcast, telecast Leaf games and get the odd Saturday in there." And so they made the offer and I said, "Oh, there's just not enough games in here. So I need more." And his selling line to me was after that was, "Well, if you come here, you'll be number two to Bob Cole as our play-by-play guy." And so... What was interesting is that about 5 years ago, Anders Ericsson, who's a defenseman who has played in the NHL a number of teams, including the Maple Leafs and the Flames, when he was married to Don Wallace's daughter. And 5 years ago or so, Don came out to Calgary at Christmas to be with his family, with his daughter and the grandkids and so on. And I was sitting with him in the stands at the Saddle Dome at the morning skate one day, and I said to him, we were talking about that, what was going on back in the 80s, and I said to him, "You know, your big selling point was that it'd be number two to Bob Cole." I said, "You know, if I'd have taken that job, I'd still be number two to Bob Cole." And so we had a good chuckle. We had a good chuckle over that. So, but I was glad I stayed in Calgary because I got to be the play-by-play guy in three Stanley Cup finals involving the Flames. That wouldn't have happened in Toronto.
You kept your friendships, or a lot of them, through most of your career, you know, and at every NHL stop along the way, a down homer would show up and meet you. I think I was the representative in Ottawa for a couple of years, and you were so gracious. You always set me up with a press pass. But you met people through almost every city in the NHL from down home, didn't you?
Yeah, it would seem everywhere you go, you'd run into somebody that had involvement from the Maritimes, be it New Brunswick or PEI or Nova Scotia. And you know, in the last 10 or 12 years, we've always had a Maritime NHLers charity golf tournament that would go on in the month of July, and they would rotate that around from Moncton to Halifax to Charlottetown in each year. And this would bring together a whole bunch of Maritimers that were involved in the NHL, be it as a player or a coach or a broadcaster or in management or whatever. So that also allowed me to meet more Maritimers. And then when you'd see them along the trail on the hockey beat, you'd sit back and have a good chat with them and maybe go out and have a lunch or a dinner and have a beer and that type of thing. So, it was always nice to run into people from down home. I've never lost my attachment to where I was from, and if it hadn't been for the opportunities that I had in Campbellton to broadcast there and the great leagues that they had in the Maritimes at that time, I wouldn't have had the career I had. So I've never forgotten the importance of the people back home.
Yeah, I think you displaying your roots as proudly as you did was part of your strength in how you were as a broadcaster. One of your favorite stories was John LeBlanc from Campbellton, who had made the NHL. For those who don't know, John LeBlanc was a Campbelltonian who played, 86 games, I believe, in the NHL?
Johnny played, let me see, I think it was 86 games in the NHL, and he scored 29 goals. And so that, 86 games basically is one full season, although he spread those out over 4 or 5 years. But when you look at the number of goals that he scored in those games, I mean, that today would get him a contract that would pay him about $5 to $6 million a year. And anytime I see John, we talk about that, and the interesting part of that is a lot of those 29 goals he scored when I was the broadcaster. And he never played for the Flames, but he played for Winnipeg, he played for Vancouver. And, of course, in those days, the Flames would play those teams a lot. But I'll never forget the night in Winnipeg when they decided to put the game, our broadcast, on CKNB in Campbellton. The Flames were playing the Jets that night, and Johnny was playing for the Jets. And Johnny got 2 goals, and he had 1 assist, and the Jets won the game. I think it was 4-3 or 5-3. I forget which. But anyway, Johnny was the number one star. So after the game, he and I go out, and we're having a few beers. And so I said to him, I said, if I were broadcasting all of your games, we'd have you as a superstar in the NHL. And then he said, yeah, get nothing to do with you. Just joking. And I said, well, you wouldn't have got 2 goals and an assist tonight if I hadn't been here. And then I said to him, what gratitude do I get even when the game? So we had good laughs every time we got together. But that night, that was a Friday night in Winnipeg. And, of course, Friday night is a big hockey night in Campbellton way back when and even today. So, Johnny and I always have a good chat about the times that he played in the NHL. It's unfortunate he didn't have a longer career in the league. And when he when he was playing, the salaries certainly weren't what they are today.
Another friendship you made through the NHL of somebody back home was Brenda Best. Can you tell us that story, how you met Brenda?
Well, Brenda, that's another very interesting story. Brenda, of course, is from Campbellton. I didn't know her at the time that I met her for the first time, but I knew some of her family back home, but I had not known her until this night in Nashville. Was very early on after Nashville had come into the NHL, and that was a road trip. That was the final game of a road trip the Flames had, where they played the first 3 games were in Montreal, Toronto, and Ottawa, and then went to Nashville to play the last game of that trip. So in addition to having the games in those 3 Canadian cities that I talked about, my brother Noonan and some friends were at 2 of those games, and also had some other friends at the one in Toronto. And so there was some socializing that I did after those games. So this night in Nashville, I believe it was a Monday night, and the game was on Tuesday. And so when we got to Nashville, I said, I'm not going anywhere tonight. I'm going to rest up and get my sleep back and prepare for tomorrow night's game. And so I'm in the hotel room. We didn't have cell phones in those days. And I get a phone call, and it's from Theo Fleury. And he was a player with the Flames. And Theo says, you got to come down to Tootsie's. You got to come down here. I said, no, I'm worn out from drinking. I'm not going anywhere. I'm staying here. No, you got to come. I said, no, I'm not going anywhere. And finally, they were trying to coax me to go. He was, and some of the other guys were in the background yelling, you got to come, blah, blah, blah. And so then I said, no, I'm not going. And I kind of hung up the phone. Well, they called right back. And again, they said, you have to come down here. You got to come here. It wasn't far from the hotel. So finally, I said, why do I have to go there? Because I see you guys every day. I don't need to see you tonight. And the guy said, no, there's somebody here that wants to see you. And so it turned out it was Brenda Best, and I went down, and Brenda was entertaining at the Tootsie's Bar, which is right on the strip there in Nashville, Broadway Street, I think is what they call it. It's right near where the building is that the Predators play. So anyway, I walk in there, and I see this lady up on the stage singing. I don't know who it is. I don't know her, obviously. And then, of course, when she finished her set, she came over and she had already chatted with the boys. And anyways, she told me who she was, and right away we started reminiscing and talking about her family, talking about Camilton, and she talked about her career and how she wound up in Nashville. And so just about every time after that the Flames would go to Nashville, we'd get together one form or another, whether she was entertaining or it was a night where she had some time off, we'd go and have dinner or whatever. So it was great night, and a great surprise that night to see someone from my hometown out there entertaining in this bar, where this bar is where a lot of these stars get their start. They go in there and they work and sing songs and just play for tips, and hoping that some music director or producer will catch their work and lead them on to great stardom. And so she's gone on to some great career in her own right, and certainly she worked very, very hard to attain that.
Absolutely, and she's going to be a guest on a future show. As you know, Brenda has been nominated for a Grammy this year, so we're all excited back home, and all of her fans are.
Yes, I've sent her an email hoping that not only gets the final nomination, but she gets to win the Grammy. So I feel really, really good for her, because I know how much she's put into it, how she's had to struggle. I mean, I was there watching her, and she go into perform at these places, and I mean, she has to carry her own equipment and park in the front door, bring all the equipment in, then go park the car about four blocks away, and then have to walk back and hope nobody stole any of her equipment. And that's why we'd hang out and have another beer to make sure nobody did so before she got back there. So I mean, it wasn't an easy life for her getting to where she is today, but that's the price you pay to get what you want in life as you pursue it. So she's certainly worked extremely hard to get to where she is.
She's earned her way, and it's good to hear you say those things, because they're all true.
Yep, absolutely. And I kind of wish that she'd had even more success in her career, because she's certainly earned it on the amount of work that she's put into it.
Oh, it's coming, Peter. It's coming.
Four room shack, shingled, weathered, and gray. Gravel road is how we left it that day, a few weeks when Daddy passed away. The city came by and told us to leave, tore down our house, and now I still grieve for the old days where we used to play. 20 years later, our street's been renamed. A stroll to the eminent domain. Back in the hills, my own Hollywood Hills. I dreamed of fame and fortune in my own backyard. Back in the hills, my own Hollywood Hills. There's a busy Sunset Boulevard. Poured fresh cement down on memory lane. Jumped in feet first, just like John Wayne. Left my boot prints and made my will come around. Strong foundation still standing, that's all that really matters. Back in the hills, my own Hollywood Hills, I dreamed of fame and fortune in my own backyard. Sunset Boulevard.
That's Brenda Best and Eminent Domain on Down Home Corner. That's Brenda's autobiographical song about growing up in Campbellton. Brenda, we look forward to having on a future show, but now back to our interview with Peter Maher.
But getting back to your roots and everything, when you were inducted into the Hockey Hall of Fame, that weekend was amazing. And what was so cool for me covering that whole event was every event I showed up to, I always ran into somebody from Campbellton. It might have been Robert Allen at one event. It might have been Bob Savoy at another event. But that was so cool how you brought them all into it, and then eventually they took over. You didn't have anything to do with it anymore.
Well, it was pretty interesting how that all evolved. Is that, you know, when the word came out that I was going to be inducted into the Hall of Fame, you know, these people all wanted to come, and I'm saying, well, gee, how am I going to get all these people there? And so, as it turned out, pulling some strings with some of the acquaintance that I had around the NHL, I was able to facilitate and get them all into the various events that were going on, and they actually got to enjoy that Hall of Fame weekend a lot better than I did. I mean, I got to enjoy the parts on the Monday where the ceremonies take place, but some of those guys came in on the Thursday beforehand, and they had passes and invitations to a whole bunch of things that were going on there, and so they had themselves quite a 4 or 5 days that were there. And we get together with them, they still reminisce about all of the great time that they had. I was able to have my two brothers, my two sisters were there for that, and also, as you mentioned, a whole bunch of my friends from Campbellton coming up for that event. Because for myself, the Flames had a game to play on the Saturday night, and so I stayed in Vancouver overnight after that game and flew into Toronto on the Sunday, getting there at about 4 or 5 in the afternoon, and that night we had our party, because Sunday night is party night on the Hockey Hall of Fame weekend, because on Monday that's when the ceremonies take place. So I was also fortunate the same year that I was inducted was that Harley Hotchkiss, who was one of the owners of the Flames right from day one here in Calgary, was also inducted into the Hall of Fame. So we had two parties on the Sunday night, and got to enjoy all of that. And then, of course, Monday with all the festivities that went on. And I remember on the Monday night after the festivities at the Grand Hall, going to the location where we had our party on Sunday night, which was just 3 or 4 doors down, and in there and having a lot of good cheer with all of the guys from down home. And then looking at my watch and realizing it was about 12:30, 12:45, and saying, boys, I've got to go. I've got a flight to catch first thing tomorrow morning because I have a game tomorrow night back in Calgary. So they continued on with the party, and I went back to the hotel and got a little bit of rest and headed out the next day. But no, it made that event so much more enjoyable, being able to share it with the family members and all of my pals from back in New Brunswick, as well as the pals that I'd gathered here in Calgary. And I think it was you coined the phrase Peter's posse, and so that has gained all kinds of traction since then.
That's my contribution to your career, Peter. Well, what's great about it is Campbellton during those ceremonies in Toronto not only well represented but made a lasting impression on both the NHL and the Hockey Hall of Fame crowd, and that was so nice to see as a Campbelltonian.
Well, recently I had lunch with Bill Hay, who was at that time was the president of the Hockey Hall of Fame. He's since retired, and he's from Calgary, and he was a former NHL player back in the 50s and the early 60s with Chicago. But he always, after that night, he's always said, the greatest party ever at the Hockey Hall of Fame was that night that weekend when Peter's Posse took over Toronto. And, you know, every year that he went after that, I said, well, was there anybody have a bigger party than what we had? And he said, no, it's still number one. And so when I had lunch with him here over the summer, he again said that party's still the biggest one that they've ever had down there. So, they certainly left their mark on the Hall of Fame and the NHL, as you mentioned.
Ah, no surprise to me. I was there.
And you were the only guy that got the recording of the presentation that they had in the afternoon for me. So that was pretty cool.
Yes, and for those who don't know, what happened was I recorded it from the table, and Rob Curd, also, who was working for your radio station, also had tried recording it patched into their system, and they had a glitch in there, and it wasn't a good recording that they could use, and so they were able to use mine, and I was happy enough to be able to pass it on. I felt good about that. I felt, well, maybe I earned a little earned keep here, you know, kind of thing.
Yeah, you know, ever since then, that ceremony now, it's completely recorded by the Hall of Fame. So they learned from the from that, and because you were the only one that was able to get the complete recording of it, they have a much more sophisticated system for recording there now. So you've left your mark in the hall.
Right on. I knew someday, Peter. Thank you.
So one of these days, I expect that they're going to put a plaque up there for Steve Bisciau.
Ah, well, I am going to have to pay to get it up there and probably break in when they're closed. But thank you. That's sweet of you, Peter.
Back in 2006, I covered Peter's Hockey Hall of Fame induction ceremony and events connected with it. And here's what some notable names had to say about Peter Marr. NHL Commissioner Gary Bettman.
Mr. Bettman, what kind of words and thoughts could you say about Peter Marr?
He has been the consummate professional, both in terms of the quality of what he does and for the duration that he's been able to do it.
Errol Sutter says he's a throwback to the old days. Would you agree with that?
You know what? He's a throwback, but he also works really well now, and I think all of our fans, young and old, love listening to him.
Now that he's won an award, he hasn't put in his resignation or anything, has he?
Absolutely not. We wouldn't let him.
Thank you for your time, Mr. Bettman.
Thank you.
Montreal Canadiens Hockey Hall of Fame legendary broadcaster Dick Irvin.
He became a very good friend, Peter, of mine. We played a lot of golf together over a period of about 20 years when I used to go to the Calgary Flames tournament, the charity tournament every year. And so he certainly deserves, I mean, people in Calgary who I know, and I know a lot of them, they just swear by Peter and the job he does for the Flames. He's one of the best broadcasters in the National Hockey League, no question.
You talked about meeting a lot of people from New Brunswick and Campbellton.
Oh, yeah, they're all here. I mean, this is the time. It's a great time for them, you know. They're taking over, and that's the way it should be.
Well, there should be a little bit of beer left at the end of the night, hopefully.
Well, it's their decision, not mine.
Olympic gold medalist and former captain of Canada's women's Olympic hockey team, and now Hockey Night in Canada broadcaster Cassie Campbell.
I don't know about Peter. I'm just joking.
Well, how do you know Peter?
You know what? I've been so blessed to have the opportunity to work with him on the occasion in the Fan 960, and he's such a gentleman, and he's always treated me with a great deal of respect, and he's very knowledgeable and well-respected in Calgary, but in Canada too. And, you know, I don't want to say we're like best friends or anything, but I definitely can say that, you know, that anything he ever needed, I would definitely be there for him. He's just one of those great men.
You getting into broadcasting recently, you've got a good role model, don't you?
I do, and he works so hard behind the scenes, and I think that's one thing that I've learned to respect about him the most, is that he doesn't just show up and take things for granted, and he does his homework and his research, and, you know, that's definitely rubbed off on me a lot.
Former coach and general manager of the Calgary Flames, and now coach of the Los Angeles Kings, Stanley Cup champion, Daryl Sutter.
Daryl, just wondering, you have a few thoughts and words you could say about Peter? What are your thoughts?
Well, first of all, everybody ties the media player thing together always, and as you and I talked about a little bit last night, you know, Peter's one of there's not many of the old school guys left. You look around the room today and you see Bob Cole and Peter Marr and And there's not many of those guys left where the relationship is still goes past the game, sort of, where it's still a friendship or a trust or a bond or a fan type relationship. And I think when I see Peter, that's what I see. I see somebody that I still see as a confidant and somebody you can talk to personally, somebody you can do something with outside the game. That's not, even though we've come to know each other because of the game, what the game's given us, but it goes beyond that, and that's what's special. And that's why Peter today putting the blue jacket on is great for him, and it's great for his family, and you know what's even neater is the fact that he's still in his prime. You know, he's being given an award almost like a player does when he's a superstar still. So I don't know if there's anybody better. I'm a little biased, but I don't know if there's anybody better.
The year that you guys did the big Stanley Cup run a couple of years ago, and Peter's comment when Marty Jelena scored the winning goal in overtime, the yeah, baby, three times, that ran on ESPN for a long time. Everybody in North America knew who Peter Marr was.
Well, I think that, you know, that's something about broadcasting and the media now. It becomes more of an international stage, and I think Peter was obviously well enough known in Canada, but that made it a North American call.
But the other great thing on your resume, so to speak, would be when you covered the Vancouver Olympics, and that must have been a surreal experience for you, and especially the way it ended and all.
Yeah, that was a huge, huge experience and thrill for me in 2010 to have been selected to be the play-by-play broadcaster on a network right across Canada from Sportsnet to broadcast all of the Canadian games, men's games in that event. And, of course, that included the gold medal game when Canada was able to prevail, I should say. See, I'm not broadcasting anymore. I'm getting my words all fluttered. But anyhow, but yeah, Canada was able to prevail in that game against the U.S. that went to overtime. You know, and his being there for the entire 2 weeks and experiencing the Olympics was a phenomenal, phenomenal experience. And the events that I was able to attend over and above the hockey, and then all of the atmosphere that was going on in Vancouver and surrounding that. And then, of course, capping it all off with that game on Sunday afternoon for the gold medal, and the tension that game ultimately built up with the Americans scoring there in the closing minute to force the game into overtime, and then having the intermission and all of those fans in the building so nervous that you hope the Americans don't score, and if they do, it's not going to be a very friendly or fun time in the building, and blah, blah, blah. There was all kinds of tension in there. I don't know what it was like for the players, but I know it was like for the fans, and even as broadcasters, we were on pins and needles as well. And then, of course, Sidney Crosby would ultimately score the goal that would give Canada the gold medal with that tally in overtime. And it had a little bit added significance for me in that, you know, Sidney Crosby being a Maritimer, and the player who set him up for that goal was the guy who I knew best on the Canadian team, Jerome Iginla. So it was real fitting icing on the cake, the way that it all culminated in Vancouver back in 2010 with that gold medal win.
Now, Peter, I know you're a humble guy, so this may be difficult for you to give an answer in this, but what legacy do you think you leave the NHL after retiring?
Well, I like to think that the legacy that I left behind is that on each and every broadcast, I was giving as much as I could to the game. I never wanted to cheat anybody with a performance. I always felt that when I got the opportunity to be a broadcaster in the NHL, it was a privilege to do that and also an honor to do that. And in return, it was me wanting to give back to the game with the strongest performance that I could give every night. And I always strive to do that in each and every broadcast. And hopefully that is the lasting impression that I have for fans that listened to me over all those years that I had the opportunity to be a play-by-play broadcaster in the NHL.
You always held it sacred, and I think we always appreciated that about you.
Yeah, well, I think there's not many jobs for play-by-play broadcasters in the NHL, and the fact that I had one of 30 radio jobs in the league. And when I started, there were 21 teams in the NHL. So I was fortunate to be one of 21 radio broadcasters. Out of all of the broadcasters that are out there, I was blessed to have that opportunity to do that. And I've always cherished the fact that it was important to treat it with the ultimate degree of respect. And that's the way I approach each and every game.
Well, Peter, I just want to close with the story of how you probably helped put me over the line to become a true sports fan. Was that night when I was a 12-year-old and you broadcast the Hardy Cup Championship game between the Campbellton Tigers and the Rosetown, what were they called?
Rosetown Red Wings.
Red Wings, okay. Yeah, and it was a school night, and I got to stay up late because it was out west, and, you know, it was late into the night when we actually had the broadcast go, you know, the whole thing was finished. So, you know, that's one of my great memories, you know, and to think that you went on to the NHL and had a Hall of Fame career, you know, it's a warm feeling you get from that, you know?
Yeah, well, you know, you mentioned that that time in Rosetown. That game was played on a Tuesday night, and I think the time difference was 3 hours from Rosetown to Campbellton. So that meant the game didn't start till about 11 o'clock at night, I believe. And for a kid like you to stay up, and I know you weren't the only one, because a lot of allowed their kids to stay up that night because it's such a monumental game, a game five of a best of five series of a series that was played in its entirety out in that Saskatchewan town, and have the Tigers pull through and win that game. You know, it was a huge, huge night for the city of Campbellton. It was the first Hardy Cup Championship, Canadian Championship, the team had ever won, and doing it under the circumstances that we talked about. And, you know, having you bring back some great memories, the fact that you were a youngster at home listening to that game, because that game stands out as another of the highlights that I got to broadcast over my career. So it's just being the right place, the right time, I guess, is something that has often been said, and I've been very fortunate to have been in the right place at the right time on many occasions.
Now, a Flames player, Curtis Glencross, his father listened to that series in Saskatchewan, right?
Yes, he did, because he was in Saskatchewan at that time. I'm trying to think the name of the town that he was in, Provost, I think it was, and he was actually a player in the same league as the Rosetown Red Wings at that particular time. And we reminisced about that a couple of years ago. I didn't know that until he and I were having a beer one night with Curtis's dad about that. And also, another interesting aspect of it is that the coach of the Rosetown team, and one of the players, who's the player coach, was Byron McCrimmon. And later, his son, Brad, would play for the Calgary Flames. In fact, he was a member of the Flames Stanley Cup team in 1989. When Brad came to the Flames, Byron came to Calgary one point, and I went over to him and I introduced myself, and he knew who I was. But it was interesting at that time. They never ever gave the Tigers, I thought anyway, at that time, and even then, you know, many years later, never really truly gave the Tigers, I thought, the full credit they deserved for going into that little barn that they had in Rosetown and playing an entire five-game series there and winning it with a very small team when it comes from the standpoint. The Flame players, most of them were not very big. Talked about Robert Allen earlier. He was the biggest guy on the team, but everybody, a bunch of the other guys were midgets in size, and the Rosetown team had a very big, big team. And, in fact, the hardest hit that I've ever seen in a hockey game occurred in the last game of that series, that game five, in which Byron McCrimmon put a solid check on Gordy Gallant, who was playing for the Tigers, and Gordy flew from one blue line to the other. Now, the ice surface there wasn't your standard NHL size, so the neutral zone wasn't quite as large, but he flew from one blue line to the other, and I've never seen that happen before or since in a hockey game, and Gordy ended up with some broken ribs from that hit. He went off the ice, and Dr. Paul Doucette was on the trip with the Tigers at that time, and he started working on Gordy, getting him back into condition so he can come back and finish the game. But what's interesting, Gordy came back out and finished it up in the third period, helping the team win. But, you know, we thought we wouldn't see him for a couple of years after that that heavy hit that he took from a much bigger guy. But, you know, it was interesting to finish the story on that is that, you know, Brad eventually passed away in that unfortunate aircraft accident over in Russia when he'd gone over there to be a head coach in the KHL 3 years ago, 4 years ago. And they had a night for Brad after he had passed away, honoring him since he was a member of the Flames. And that night, they had at the Flame game, they had a reception afterwards. And after that, after the game, I went there and I got talking with Byron. And that was the first time, and it was probably 20 years after the fact, actually, it was more than 20 years after the fact. It was more like 30 years after the fact that he finally conceded that the Tigers had a lot of guts in beating the Red Wings in that playoff series, since they're such a small team and took such a physical beating. So I told him, well, Byron, you finally mellowed. and I saw him again this past summer when we had a reunion here for the Flames Stanley Cup team of 89. And again, he offered... He offered a great respect for that Tiger team, but it took him a long time to come around from that. He took that loss so hard.
Well, that just says how good of a team that we had that year, you know?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So there's another story. Gosh. Steve, you bring out all those stories in me.
Well, thank you. Well, we'll have to have another program on where you just tell all stories, you know? But... Peter, will we any projects you're working on? Will we hear from you again, or are you pretty well done with it?
No, I don't expect that. I don't expect I'll get back into any play-by-play broadcasting again. I've had a full career and very, very pleased to have had that and fortunate. So I'm going to dabble a bit in the broadcast business and slow down quite a bit, obviously. Someday I may write a book. I said one time I wouldn't, but something tells me that boredom is going to get me to sit down and write a book about my experiences in my hockey time. So I won't guarantee that, but it's more of a possibility today than it would have been, say, 2 years ago. I'll stay active. I'll know what's going on in the game and keep intact with as many people as I can. I mean, they're the two of the biggest things that I miss now is the camaraderie with all of the great people that I've been was involved with and got to be involved with as a broadcaster with the Flames and other teams and people right around the entire NHL and elsewhere. And also the other thing is that rush you get before each game, that adrenaline rush you get. Like, I've never been a rock star or anything like that. Obviously, it's a good thing, but I often thought anytime I get to a concert, it must be quite a rush for the singer to get up there on stage and get ready to perform in front of such a large crowd. Now, when I'm doing my broadcasting, there's a large crowd in the building in most cases, but I'm not talking to them. I'm talking to an audience where I don't know how many people are listening, but I do know that just before the end of the national anthem, there's that little surge that would hit that I'm certainly missing, and I don't know how that's going to be replaced, because my golf game will never replace that before I play the game.
Yeah, Dick Irvin mentioned that.
Yeah. Yeah, I can't play very good, but I do have fun. That's all that matters.
Peter, anybody you'd like to nominate for an upcoming show, a down-homer that you can think of?
Well, the name that comes to me, you're talking about the entire Maritimes or just whereabouts?
Why not? Anywhere down home.
Well, no, just the name that comes to me real quickly is Rick Bowness. And the reason I say that, and Rick Bowness is a guy from Halifax, who is now an assistant coach with the Tampa Bay Lightning. And he is now in his 40th season as either a player or a coach in the National Hockey League. He's been a head coach for a couple of teams, maybe three or four, been assistant with a number of teams. But he actually started his career in the NHL just a little bit ahead of me and has gone on to a real lengthy career. And he is the guy that initiated the Maritime NHLers golf tournament that we have every summer. And it's brought in a lot of important money for kids that couldn't afford to play the game, allowed them to get equipment and pay for ice time and all that sort of thing. So I think he'd be a real interesting guy to talk to.
So Rick Bowness, okay, a down homer. We'll have to think of him for a future show, and we'll definitely contact him.
Yeah, I think he'd have a real interesting chat with Rick because he's a real interesting guy. He's a he's a Maritimer. He likes to have a good time and is always helpful. So that would be the guy I would nominate right off the top of my head here quickly. Probably a whole bunch after. I'll think about later, but anyhow, that's one guy.
Well, if you think of others, we'll definitely get those from you. Well, Peter, I have a lot of thanks for you. First of all, thanks for doing the show, and I so appreciate you making the time to do this. But thank you so many things over the years. I mean, for giving, as I say, a young hockey-crazed kid some wild play-by-play fun broadcasts, and then later on meeting up with you, and then you always being available for interviews when I asked, even when I wasn't connected to the media. You were always out there, and you always were gracious and humble, and for being so kind and everything. I thank you for all of that. A lot of people don't know the charity work you do and the many wonderful things you do for other people, but you certainly are a wonderful ambassador to not only the game and the Flames and way back when the Tigers and the Rangers, but you've been a wonderful ambassador for Campbellton and down home, and as a down homer and a Campbelltonian, I thank you for that.
Well, thank you very much for the very kind words, Steve. I've always felt it's important to give back, and that's what I do, and also try to be helpful to people. And I wish you all the best with this project, and hopefully it takes off, and you'll wind up having a billion listeners to all of your shows down the road.
I'm going to get some spikes now that I got Peter Marr on the air with me.
Yeah, baby.
Put it in the I got a yeah, baby. Thank you, Peter. Thank you so much, and all the best in retirement. For the
Americans. Thank you.
And now it's Crosby stepping into the U.S. zone, tries to get to the net. He's knocked off stride. Puck slides to the goal mouth, however. Now Crosby has a lovely board. Gets a left corner to Aginla. Aginla front cut. C.C. Crosby.
And I want to end our program with a story about Peter Marr. You know how I say we are all connected? Listen to this. I was 16 years old, and I had gotten myself a part-time job at CKNB Radio in Campbellton, the same station that Peter Marr was working for. I met Peter a few times and used to run into him from time to time in the hallway, and he was always gracious and always had time to talk sports with a fan-crazed 16-year-old. Anyway, at 16, I wasn't allowed on the air yet, but I was given Saturday and Sunday nights as an operator. I played tapes and time-delayed CBC shows and commercials and records and basically babysat the building, something a lot of this done by computers and automation today. Now, the first time I ever turned the mic on and spoke on the air was actually because of Peter Marr. It was a Saturday night, and we were covering the North-South All-Star Game being held in Campbellton at Memorial Gardens. Peter was at the rink, and I was the operator back at the station. Peter sent an interview over the phone that I was supposed to record and play during the first intermission. Only problem was after I hung up, I realized I hadn't turned the tape machine on. Now, I was scared to death. In my 16-year-old mind, I was going to be fired, and my radio career was over. And the levels I had tested were perfect, too, by the way. So I called the rink. They tracked Peter down, and this is minutes before the game was about to begin and we were going to go on the air. So he runs after his subject again to get a second interview. Now we're running out of time and breath, and Peter records it again. Yeah, again. So anyway, he was so nice about this. He kept saying, it's okay, and I kept saying, sorry, Peter. All I could think of to say was, technical difficulties. And I kept saying it over and over, sorry, Peter, technical difficulties. And then I told him we had another problem, that I couldn't find the recorded intro for the game in my panic, and I found it later, of course. Well, anyway, Peter tells me I have to turn the mic on and go on the air and do the intro live. So I did. My voice cracked. I sounded like a little girl, and I probably stumbled through every word of it, and that was the start of one of my dreams. The first time on the radio, I had accidentally become the person I'd always wanted to be, a radio announcer. And by the next summer, I had my own show, and I was on top of the world, living my dream for minimum wage. Anyway, long story short, I did apologize to Peter 30 years later and came clean on the incident. And Peter was so gracious. He just laughed and said, don't worry about it. Do you know how many interviews that I've done before games and forgot to turn the tape machine on? I don't want to tell you how many times. So we laughed about it, and it was a cool story in the end. But again, as I say, we are all connected.
Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby. Yeah, baby.
Well, that's our show for this time around, Webisode 2, if you're keeping track or scoring at home. Thanks so much to our special guest, Peter Marr. We at Down Home Corner are working on some cool ideas and guests for the next and upcoming shows, and we hope you'll continue to listen. Please share this show on your Facebook page, and we'll reach and connect with even more Down Homers. Our email address is downhomecorner@hotmail.com. Visit us and like us on Facebook. We'll post info on upcoming shows and a whole lot of other things. Down Home Corner is produced by Mike Cicada and Steve Bijou. Thanks for listening. I'm Steve Bijou, and I'm a Down Homer. If you're a Down Homer too, remember, we are all connected.